We've all seen it happen too often. One might say a woman walking on a street and then a man, or in some cases a group of men, yell out something lewd. The traditional description for behavior like that is catcalling, and it's seen as a harmless bit of fun, if you're the man doing it. Women, however, have another name for this, and that's harassment. American comedian Jen Kirkman was in Melbourne last week for the Comedy Festival, and walking home late one night, she experienced exactly this sort of harassment, and when she ignored it, she was called a bitch. And to further drive home this point that women suffer extreme reactions from men in the most innocuous of situations, a bake sale at the University of Queensland last week resulted in rape threats.
It was sort of marred by the sort of build-up to the event, and a lot of the online discussions were not so positive. It degenerated to, you know, rape threats and death threats to the organiser, Madeline Price, and a lot of her women's collective volunteers, which was just pretty atrocious, to be honest, and very upsetting.
That's Gabby Starr, the secretary of the University of Queensland Student Union. I spoke to her earlier in the week about the purpose of this bake sale.
So the idea of the bake sale was that it was all baked goods were set at $1, and then certain factors about yourself gave you a sort of percentage discount. So I guess the main one being that women generally were given a discount over men, but it was also sort of mediated by your faculty, so what you study, as well as whether you're a person with a disability or a person of colour, or a person who identifies as LGBTIQA+.
And for this bake sale, the organisers were inundated with messages like, and I'm quoting here, kill all women. I can't actually read any of the others because that's the mildest one. With me are Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, a political scientist at Melbourne University, writer and social researcher, and Emeritus Professor Sheila Bulbeck, specialising in gender studies and social analysis at Adelaide University. Lauren, let's start with you. These attacks and this sort of severe harassment, it's common. What effect does that have on women overall?
So one of the studies is that street harassment makes women, for example, change the way that they commute, avoiding certain destinations, not taking public transport at night for fear that they will be harassed. We've seen this type of harassment move online, where it's an extension, where taking advantage of the anonymity of cyberspace, harassment that women once had on the street in public space has now been moved online. So this idea of avoiding hostile exchanges is becoming ever more unavoidable for women.
Sheila, in your experience, has that been the same thing where it just limits safe spaces, if you will?
Yes, obviously. Lauren's right about that. And just in terms of the exposure to harassment and men's inability to understand it, there was a young woman in New York about a year ago. She just took a video, or she had somebody video recording her as she walked down a New York street for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. And the number of times that she was harassed or commented on or, you know, sort of propositioned was truly astonishing, not only to a number of men who fortunately did see the video, but also to other women. So, it's really much more pervasive than people on the whole understand, particularly for young women. I actually don't get harassed on the street anymore. I've become invisible, as Jermaine Greer likes to say older women are. But I wanted to make another point about what these men were objecting to and failing to understand. And so there's a 17% full-time equivalent wage gap between men and women, and so that dictated the kind of cake sale, which got this issue into the media, which was a very important thing to do. And what these men who oppose that don't understand is that 17% wage gap is not because women are 17% more stupid than men or 17% less likely to want to work hard. It's because of the structural underpinnings of our employment situation, combined with the fact that women tend to be the carers, and so they take time out of work. So women actually are more likely to get a higher education level than men, more likely to complete university, that kind of thing. But then they go into the workforce, they take time out of work, so they don't get promoted because of discrimination. And the other thing is that our workforce is deeply gendered, and women want to be things like teachers, nurses, childcare workers. Men want to be things like driving on a mine site, plumbers, whatever. And our society deems driving a truck on a mine site as more valuable than educating our children or looking after our children.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because there are some people who believe that gender wage inequality is actually a myth. I mean, just have a listen to this.
The gender pay gap essentially is a myth. The idea is that you add up all of the money that's earned by men and you divide it by the number of men, and then you add up all of the money that's earned by women and you divide it by the number of women, and you compare the two figures and you get, as we've seen, the 17.3% figure. Now, that is an incredibly, incredibly simplistic way of looking at this issue. And, okay, on a university campus, you simplistically look at very complex social issues, fine. But the reality is that if you dig deeper into this issue, you get at the reality, which is that different people, whether they be men or women or whatever their background might be, make different choices about their career paths and the choices they make in their careers.
Now, that's Simon Branney. He's director of Legal Rights Project and director of Race Has No Place at the Institute of Public Affairs. And he's talking to ABC's Drum TV, being basically utterly wrong about how the wage gap is calculated. It's calculated by the Workplace Gender Wage Equality Agency, uses many contributing factors, and looks at a range of background details. And that's how they get the 17.9%. Lauren, the bigger problem for me over here is his use of the word choice. That people choose to get how much they get. It's not a choice.
No, and this is where we talk about the feminization of certain careers and certain jobs, where nursing, social work, teaching are professions that we've come to think of as women's professions. And as a result, women have been able to negotiate smaller salaries for themselves based on cultural values about caring. And caring has been culturally seen as women's work and therefore something that women would do freely and domestically. So why should we be paying the big dollars for it as compared to professions men have been traditionally involved in?
You know, we've seen the equivalent of this bake sale in the 70s and in the 80s. The reaction was very different then, wasn't it?
We've progressed far less than we believe. 5 years ago, I completed a study looking at young women's and young men's attitudes to how they were going to lead their lives together. And what was I discovered was that young men imagined they were going to get married. Well, if they talked about marriage and children at all, very fleetingly, but they would get married and their wife would look after the children and they'd go out and work. And the young women on the whole imagined that they would be sharing the caring and the loving and the intimacy with a man who would be helping them out. And so that, you know, the what I'm saying, I guess, is that kind of orientation to understanding or thinking about your future had really shifted very little. And then the sexual harassment issue is, I mean, in the 1970s, the retort to women who stood up for themselves was all she needs is a good F. So, you know, it's very, like, it's really sad how, not how little it's changed, because I think more the good thing is, and that's the good thing about those young women in my study, who knew what they wanted. Now they'll struggle to get it, but they had a clear idea that they would be in the public space and they'd be in the private space as well, and so would their partners. So that's the good thing. Women are much more out there now and much more aware of their right to be in the public space, but unfortunately men aren't aware that women have an equal right to be in the public space.
This is Sunday Extra on RN. I'm Sammy Shah and I'm speaking to Dr. Lauren Rosewarne and Emeritus Professor Sheila Bulbeck, and we're discussing the inequality and hostility faced by women. We have in Pakistan, for example, where I'm originally from, obviously sexual harassment not just the workplace but on the street and everything is very, very pervasive. One of the defences maybe that society's going to come up with is the way you stop a man from misbehaving with a woman is you say, is this how you would treat your mother or your sister, or is this how you would want someone to treat your mother and your sister? And sometimes it is effective. There isn't that same cultural statement here. Would it be effective?
Yeah, I would say absolutely not. So, and also as a feminist, I have really big concerns with you with an articulation that this is a somehow patriarchal duty or a fatherly, brotherly duty to protect women, as opposed to, hang on, would you treat your brother this way? Would you treat your father this way?
A human this way.
Yeah, is this the way you want other people treated who you consider equal? And I think it's quite limiting to think about feminism and encouraging those values in men in terms of thinking about protecting women. I don't think that's particularly helpful.
There's, Sheila pointed out an interesting thing, which was last time when in the 70s and 80s when these stories were covered, people say, oh, she just needs this or whatever. Even now, with a lot of these stories, there's a thing of like, well, how, we're just flirting. Well, a man can't flirt with a woman, and that kind of conversation comes up. And then there's a thing much like the cries of reverse racism, for example. This cries of reverse sexism is happening now. What about men's rights and things? Is there any point of listening to that? Is there any validity to those claims?
It depends on what we're talking about in terms of male and female exchanges, where is it me saying hello to you, you know, in a casual greeting in terms of male-female exchange on the street, versus I am going to rape you if you continue to talk about feminist issues and spotlighting men's power.
Right. Jill, would you have anything on that?
I think, like, in a way, I just was thinking back on what I said before, and I kind of said men do this, women do that, and I kind of put men, I guess, in the wrong. And one of the things, you know, the not all men hashtag, it's true, not all men do this, and not all women, you know, are poor, Gina Reinhart, for example. So so I think what that, but the thing about the accusation of reverse sexism and reverse racism, what it, so what it misunderstands is that there are structural underpinnings, and that women on average do earn less than men, whatever the IPA says, that people of Indigenous people, we know, you know, have far fewer opportunities. They live, you know, they die younger. I mean, they clearly are in a different space. But as an Aboriginal friend of mine said to me, Aboriginal people are racist because they, you know, attack white people, but their racism has no purchase in social power. So, yes, we are all racist and sexist.
It's theoretical, not practical, basically.
Well, it's, we are all racist and sexist. There's actually an online thing you can do where you quickly kind of allocate terms like mother or caring or whatever to sort of either sex, and there's a one for racism as well. And most of us have, you know, at that subconscious level, have these racist or sexist stereotypes in our heads, which, of course, we have to fight to overcome. But my point is that when you're being a white racist or a male sexist, you have behind you a whole structural support network that justifies that. And that was the point about, I think, that Lauren made about when male feminist allies speak up, that's okay, nobody attacks them. But when women, or even when men speak up for their own disadvantage, you know, nobody attacks them.
Right.
But if feminists speak up, but we're, you know, whinging victim feminists.
Well, I mean, Lauren, like, there's that reaction, the hashtag not all men thing, which for me, I find strange always. I feel like it's an aggressive attempt at protecting certain circles. Like, if you're actually not, if you don't believe that not all men are like that, then you shouldn't be too worried about it, you know?
And this is always the silencing technique that's used towards women, where and I was inundated with emails after my article about this topic, where men were emailing saying, well, I'm not a rapist. I haven't made any rape threats. Well, why do you feel so threatened, A, and why are you directing your anger towards me as opposed to your fellow men who are doing that behaviour? It's very interesting that it seems, yet again, it's women who are blamed for spotlighting a problem and spotlighting power disparity.
But this, it's very similar to the whole thing of, you know, quote unquote, political correctness gone mad. Everyone's, is there a place at any point where we can reach, where we can have a dialogue without one side just resorting to cliches and slogans?
But this is the nature of rhetoric, though, isn't it? With debate, where we always default to, you know, it's like throwing out the Nazi grenade, you know, stop being a Nazi. It becomes a powerful punch. And this is a silencing technique, but I'm not sure that there's a way to stop this, because you've got people with power who don't want to give it up, and therefore why would they want to give an inch in a debate?
Jill, from a social perspective, what needs to change for the shift?
What did somebody say? This, to make an asinine political point, is it an asinine political point that women are, you know, so much poorer and will be, you know, poor in retirement and whatever than men? So it's not asinine. So there's that, you know, kind of thing. But so men are protecting their privilege, even though they don't realise it. And some of that privilege is economic as well as social positioning. But the kinds of discussions and conversations and relationships that we want to have, women, I think, many women want to have, are respectful and, you know, not the rhetoric, not the angry attacking. And the other thing that I would say is, and there's lots of evidence for this as well, men might think they're better off being at the top of the heap and, you know, working hundreds of hours a week and not seeing their children and all of that kind of thing. But we actually know it's really bad for their health, just as it's bad for women's health not to be able to walk the streets at night and feel safe and whatever. So actually the society in which we'll all flourish is one where there's a lot more sharing of each other's capacities and opportunities and experiences, and that's done in a respectful and mutually supportive way. And I know I sound like a total utopian here, but, you know, in utopia we don't need feminism anymore, because we are all human, the point that you were making earlier, Sammy.
I've come across things online where there are groups of women who see feminism as a bad word. They see it as something to reject, and they're like, oh, we're not feminists because feminism is about hating men and things. And is there women's equivalent to, are they basically the women's version of not all men?
Well, no, it's just that it makes complete sense that a woman would identify against feminism when feminism has a branding reputation, and there is mileage to be made with siding with those who have power. So it's no surprise to me that you would see, for example, some women come out against feminism quite actively. They don't see themselves as A, victims or oppressed, and B, want to align themselves with those who have power.
Sheila, how much of this misogyny is just misplaced nostalgia? Men harkening back to a time when women were subservient or more subservient?
Yes, I think that you're right. Particularly, I think, for older men. I mean, I've been, not to the extent that Lauren was recently, but I've been harassed online as well. And I think a lot of that sort of white male privilege does come from older men who've been in Australian society. Many of them have been displaced by globalisation, which means they've lost those very safe, secure, fairly high paid but low skilled jobs that you once had where you made, you know, motor cars and things like that on factory lines. So yes, they, instead of blaming a global change, neoliberalism, capitalism, for what's happened, they think, oh, wasn't it nice when, you know, sort of the woman was at home looking after me and servicing me in any kind of sexual way I wanted, and she had no recourse in law and she couldn't leave because there were no domestic violence shelters, so I was just king of my domain. So, yes, I think there is that kind of nostalgia. I think it's really sad that young men also participate in this idea that that's the kind of relationship they want to have with another person. I mean, if you, I think John Stuart Mill said this: if you live with a slave, you are like a slave master. You're not. It's not a human relationship. And I think there's that failure to understand, what human flourishing is about, and to miss out on one of the most important things that we can do in society, and most rewarding. I mean, this is why women leave the workforce to be with children, because they really love it, many of them.
Right.
They really benefit from it. Why can't men have that too?
Well, I mean, I'd much rather be home with my daughter right now than doing anything else. That's a very good point. Thank you so much for your time, both
thank
of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Sammy. It was lovely to talk with you.
Thank you. That's Emeritus Professor Sheila Bulbeck, specializing in gender studies and social analysis at Adelaide University. And joining us today was also Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, a political scientist at Melbourne University, writer and social researcher. I'm Sammy Shah, and you're listening to Sunday Extra here on RN.